Hello and welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. This is the July month, and this month we are talking about AWS security. Yes, we are talking about AWS security in support of the two cloud security conferences at the end of this month, which is AWS Reinforce as well as Forward CloudSec, which we have been supporting for a long time. So definitely check out the conference on the website. And if you're attending in person, we would be there in person as well. So really looking forward to saying hello to a lot more of you and taking a lot of pictures with you folks. So today's episode, the first one, is with Kinnaird McCaid. And Kinnaird McCaid is a cloud security engineer at Square. And he was on the podcast to talk about how can you scale AWS security guardrails. What are guardrails? Are they the ones on the side of the road, or are they much more than that? What are some of the preventative, detective? When do you switch from a detective to a preventative role? Where, at what point does it become part of your culture? What are some of the challenges when you face trying to implement a security program on an AWS, especially when you are probably the only engineer for a 100 AWS account business? We also spoke about observability platforms, how you can have a successful cloud security program by having something which is measurable, especially from a guardrail perspective. And we went into the whole secret talent that Kinnaird has as well towards the end of the podcast. Definitely tune until the end of the podcast to hear some of his interesting experiences. Back and forth conversation we had with some of the people who were on live stream. And thank you for everyone who shared their experience on live stream as well. As always, if you enjoyed this free episode of Cloud Security Podcast, feel free to drop us a thank you by sharing a review or a rating on iTunes and Spotify. It really means a lot when you leave us a heart on Spotify or leave us a review or rating on the iTunes podcast. It also gives me a reason to say thank you one more time to you. So thank you to everyone who has left one review or at least a rating and given us a heart on Spotify last week. Thank you so much for doing that. Really appreciate this. It means a lot. Thank you to everyone who shared their supply chain as well as digital transformation feedback. That was really awesome that you guys enjoyed it. And because all of you enjoyed it, we are coming up with the second part of the digital supply chain as well. That should come in soon. And we have one more episode like that called Zero Trust coming soon as well. So definitely keep an eye out for that. And for everyone enjoying the long weekend in the US, have a great long weekend. Hope you have a great time with family and friends. And if you have some free time and you want to dive into cloud security, those two episodes should be coming out over the next couple of days as well. So you get to, I guess, you know, spend some spare time maybe teaching someone else cloud security, maybe share this with them over a barbecue or whatever way you're celebrating the long weekend. So enjoy the long weekend and enjoy this episode with Kinnaird McCaid. I will see you in the next episode. Stay safe. Peace. Hey, welcome Kinnaird. How are you, man?
I'm great, man. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for coming in, man. I'm really looking forward to this conversation, man.
Yeah, same. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. So, Kinnaird, before we start, I mean, out of the entire audience that we have of over 10,000 people who listen to this episodes, for people who may not have heard about you, or the one or two people who may not have heard about you, what's your journey into the whole cloud security space? Let's start there.
I started out of college doing web app pen testing and application security, and got into threat modeling. And I really liked viewing things at that high level view and then thinking like an attacker, right? But I met my mentor at the time and started working on building out a cloud security consulting practice, eventually ran that practice, and then moved to Salesforce and got into open source. And that's really where my career blew up. Like after I released Cloud Splaining and Policy Sentry, that's where I got connected with a lot of folks between the cloud security Slack and then just folks on Twitter. And it's where I made all my cloud security friends. So it's been a wild ride.
I can see that. I've been following some of it as well. So I'm so glad to have you come on the show as well. And Considering we're talking about guardrails as well, because a lot of people don't even know what guardrails are. I imagine people think of the actual guardrails on the side of the road. So what are guardrails and what's its context in the whole cloud space, maybe in AWS?
Yeah, sure. So there are, just generally speaking, provider-enforced guardrails and then customer-enforced guardrails. So the idea behind them is that they prevent you from deploying insecure things in the first place. So some examples would be like AWS service control policies, so that even if you're the root account user in a child account, then you can't do certain insecure things. Or in Azure, there's Azure policies. Customer enforced guardrails would be things like infrastructure as code policies or piggybacking off of a CI/CD pipeline that you have to make sure that insecure configurations or whatnot aren't deployed in the first place, right? But I've been thinking more about guardrails, and there's this focus on the preventative guardrails, stopping people from doing things. But if you think about like the actual physical guardrails, they don't just stop people who are about to blow off of a cliff. I haven't been a driver in this position, but if I'm starting to swerve, yeah, I might bump it and then come back on the road, right? So yeah, I feel like we should, as an industry, expand our understanding of guardrails to be those quick things and quick controls that you can do to quickly correct the developer after they've done something. Let them know, get them back on the right path.
So to your point then, with the CSP provided or the customer provided one, because I'm thinking more from a perspective of, if I'm listening to this and going, okay, I guess I've got some CSP already, they give me a few, can I just rely on them and I don't have to rely, I don't have to create customer provided guardrails? Can I just fully just make my environment rely only on the CSP provided ones?
Well, it depends more. The degree to which you can rely on it depends on the cloud provider. So Azure has more extensive guardrails than Azure policies are extensive. I wrote a tool that did a talk for CloudSec last year that really...
I'll link the talk as well. Definitely worth checking out. But I think, it's different from different CSP rather than, say, I guess, because we're talking about AWS.
Yeah.
And definitely, it's, what does it really mean for relying on just one or the other, I guess it's correct. Because I imagine people will listen to this and go, well, I guess I've got, it's already there by AWS, I'm just going to use that. Why do I have to worry about it?
Well, it's really limited, right? So you want to use those on the preventative side for preventing the egregiously bad things or things that you as an organization decide you want to enforce. So service control policy that applies to, is appropriate for some organizations but not others, is just, for example, running a Lambda out of a VPC, right? Now it's actually kind of complicated to get Lambdas running out of a VPC. So you're going to enforce that everywhere in every organization? I don't think so, right?
Yeah.
But so there are some things that might not apply in all organizations. And if you want to get as much context as possible, you're going to end up having to do customer provided guardrails.
Yep. And I think to add to what you were saying as well, it's a great example on the Lambda should run from VPC. Another one that I came across quite often is, oh, you shouldn't be able to delete databases. Like, the last thing you want is your production database being accidentally being deleted. Like, no CSP is going to tell you that, hey, this database is kind of not being done. So from that perspective as well, I think you're on the money there. I've got a question here from Vineet as well. Is the AWS guardrails free? I think it's a great question. I would love for you to kind of address that as well, if that's all right.
So things like service control policies are definitely, those are free. So, and then as you expand to other things, like there are other like monitoring things that can get expensive, but yeah, service control policies are definitely free.
Awesome. Thanks for that question, Vineet. I think worthwhile calling out as well, when we talk about guardrails, we're not talking about, I guess, a particular service. Worthwhile clarifying, because you mentioned two services, just their monitoring services as well as the SCP. So in your mind, when you think of guardrails, what are services that come to your mind? Are there other services that come to mind what people can use to implement guardrail?
I would focus a lot on the customer-provided guardrails, like with infrastructure as code checking and stuff like that.
And how would you describe... I guess your point mentioned the word preventative and detective. What's the difference there? Like, as in, like, maybe being proactive? What's the difference?
Yeah. So, for example, if I'm, let's say that I write some Terraform code that opens up an S3 bucket to the world or has encryption issues, and I run checkoff against it or another infrastructure as code auditing tool, then it can pick that up. Let's say if I'm running that out of a CI/CD pipeline, it can pick that up and you can decide to block it or allow it and just alert on it. So in practice, blocking on a ton of rules is going to be really difficult for some organizations, depending on the culture and different challenges that you might have. I've soured a bit on the preventative guardrails as time has gone on. I think the monitoring and like quick alerting, or allowing developers to be able to exclude certain things based on context, and then you zoom in on those. I think that's, as time has gone on and seeing where the industry has gone, I think that's become more practical.
Right. So preventative is more practical?
I think it's doing preventative guardrails for egregious things is effective. Like, you really should, there's no reason why you shouldn't be doing blocking public access with S3 buckets.
Yep.
There's no reason,
right?
But other things like certain encryption of certain services, is it practical to block absolutely everybody from doing that? Not always, right? So,
And to your point then, what examples of, I guess you mentioned the detection part, because I think if you zoom out a bit, we're talking about guardrails, and I wanted to address at least the folks who would be working with this, like folks like yourself in organizations who are either creating it or working through it, what are, I guess maybe, what's a great place to start this as well? Because I didn't even know there's a benchmark or something like this. Is there a benchmark?
So, I mean, it's really just a lot of advice from folks online and different lists of controls. I do have something from my OWASP talk last year where I put together some recommended list of like Chekhov rules to help people get started. So, I mean, if you look at it from a practical lens, right? Let's say there are no guardrails, there are no real controls in place, and you're trying to get set up with infrastructure as code auditing, right?
Yep.
And you already have developers using CI/CD pipelines to run infrastructure as code. If you start enforcing preventative guardrails right now in this situation, you're going to block them from being able to deploy anything, right? If they already have issues, right? So what is your option? First, you get some visibility. You start, you put things into audit mode, and then you have to buy down the bugs, right? You have to eventually get it down to zero or get to the point where you can flag a bunch of things as exceptions. But you got to stop bleeding. You kind of have to approach from both sides, right? So like defensive Terraform modules, like it's kind of like defensive libraries, right? Where you have Terraform modules that have like secured your, what you consider to be secure defaults, right?
Yeah.
Getting teams to use those so that they do pass the tests and getting them to adopt those. And that's a process. It's a long journey, right?
I'll probably get into the whole, how do you start one and build one later on as well in the show. But maybe the next half would be to get into, how do you even scale this? To your point, we have figured out we have a guardrail for S3 bucket shouldn't be public. We have a guardrail for you shouldn't be able to delete databases, which are production databases or whatever. And I don't know, like we can come up with 100 more depending on the organization. But the question, which is probably the big one, is it's great when you and I say this for one account.
Yeah,
clearly, it's not the common norm these days that people only have one AWS account. People have scaled up to two, three, sometimes hundreds of AWS accounts. Yeah, so
thousands, yeah.
How does one work with scaling this?
Well, you have to figure out how, you have to be able to measure it, prioritize it, and then figure out how you can buy down entire sections of it, right? So, and it depends. So if you look at creating a hypothetical scenario, right? Like let's say that, okay, we throw some monitoring on there, we're using some paid CSPM tool, and we see that people are assigning the administrative access policy to a bunch of roles, or we're seeing that there are misconfigured S3 buckets all over the place, right? You can, based on what you're seeing and based on customer feedback and the numbers, you can figure out, okay, out of all of these, what are the most critical issues? And then what are different strategies that I can use to help buy down those issues? And I really think that as far as cloud misconfigurations go, infrastructure as code is the best way to handle that.
So infrastructure is the best way to go start with this guardrail?
Infrastructure as code and having others adopt it, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. Also, to your point, this needs to be a certain level of maturity in the organization to be already starting to use infrastructure as code to kind of go down this path effectively.
It depends on the size of the organization. But yeah, I mean, first of all, you have to be able to measure things, right? And be able to see how many misconfigured resources you have and which ones are the most critical. So whether that's using things that come from the cloud provider or open source tools or paid tools, right? So first you have to measure it. That's the very first thing. So
Would be individual to each organization as well, to what you were saying.
Yeah, depending on what you're choosing, what's within your budget, etc.
And it's funny because when we started talking about scaling, the first thought that came to my mind was maybe we'll use CI/CD pipeline, because that's what people keep throwing at us. So is there a part for CI/CD pipeline in anywhere in this?
Yeah, definitely. This CI/CD pipeline is a really good insertion point. If you're doing infrastructure as code and you're pulling via CI/CD pipeline, it's a really unique insertion point to be able to audit for these kind of things. So not everything is in fact like always reflected in the CI/CD pipeline. Sometimes folks might make changes in production, or maybe you have some vendor CloudFormation stack that is actually going and creating infrastructure that isn't reflected in your infrastructure's code, or some Lambda's changing things, right? But for the most part, if you have CI/CD, if you can deploy things via infrastructure as code, that's a really, really good place to start buying down, to monitor things and start buying down classes of bugs.
Right. I think, and I love, could you explain the whole buying out classes of bugs? Because a lot of people I don't think they understand the concept, because for them, it's like, I'm going to use a web app example, but it could be anything else. Like, could be cross-site scripting. Oh, okay, I need to get rid of cross-site scripting. But what you're talking about is scaling. So can we zoom into the whole take out classes of bugs? Because you and I get it. A lot of other people may get it, but some people will be like, what are they on about? So how would you describe removing classes of bugs to people who may not have heard of the concept
before? Yeah. So it is kind of similar to, if we're comparing the infrastructure as code to like AppSec, right? It is kind of like those defensive libraries, like, or just having some libraries that will do the job for you, right? Like, I mean, with SQL injection, the risk in that, like OWASP has recognized that, hey, the risk of SQL injection has gone down a lot because everybody's using ORM libraries these days, right? And so rather than running like raw SQL queries.
Yeah.
So similarly, if you see some systemic issues across your environment and you trace that back to where that's happening at the source, whether that's looking at the source code yourself or just working with dev teams, then you can figure out where are these misconfigurations coming from. And like, if there are thousands of IAM users, there's probably some automation that has something to do with that. So if you can figure out where that source is and then eliminate those problems at the source, then you're going to find later on that you won't have as many bugs being opened, or you won't have as many results happening from that CSPM tool.
Yep. And so to summarize, I think what you're referring to is basically identifying if you see more than one of a particular bug. Well, a bug in this context could be IAC bug, but you're kind of like, oh, is there an automation that maybe is scaling this out? I address that. I think I can address the whole problem rather than just finding individual accounts to look at. Oh, okay, account number one, account number two, account number three, and account number all the way to 80. That's not practical.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have to zoom in on some of those results, and it's kind of like taking samples, right? And I find it's really useful to interview folks about what they're doing and how they're using the cloud, even away from just security things. And I love talking to people in the industry about this and how they're using the cloud, even folks who are not security. You find out a lot about why certain security things happen and some cool things about what people are building.
Wait, so what's the most, I wasn't going to use the word scariest, but what's the most interesting, let's just say that, what's the most interesting way of you, someone told you that this is how we use cloud?
Well, I'm really into serverless these days. So I find it to be really interesting, the teams that are all serverless, or I see it more with some startups or some orgs within bigger companies where they just don't have any EC2 instances or stuff like that. That's crazy to me. Yeah.
Wait, so using cloud just as serverless, the entire thing is built on serverless.
Yeah. I haven't talked to a lot of folks who are like that, but that fascinates me. So.
Yep. I think it does fascinate me as well, because we did a whole month of this end of 2021. Mm-hmm. And we had someone that they had made a product which was just on monitoring performance of Lambdas. Now, for people who may have worked on AWS Lambdas, it's monitoring it, working through it, it's insane. Now, but when you have a whole organization that just runs only on Lambda, imagine how do you troubleshoot anything or monitor anything? So,
it's
they got purchased by VMware, I think, but great product. But to your point, it definitely fascinates me as well.
Yeah, they do it with observability tooling, man. There's my life before observability tooling, and there's my life after. They're two completely different things.
Yep, 100%. I think we definitely need more observability in our life as well.
Too bad I can't set breakpoints in Lambdas.
Oh, yeah. That's it. We need to do a whole episode on Lambdas as well. But I think the other thing that people talk about, and going back to the whole security guardrails as well, we spoke about how do you scale it and how do you kind of approach it. I guess a lot of people, they would just be looking at building a security program for AWS. A lot of people may be starting off today. And my understanding is you've done some work in that as well, where you've kind of thought about how do you start implementing an AWS security program. How would you describe the building blocks for, say, someone to build an AWS security program? Where does even one start with these kind of things?
The things that will really help you out is having some kind of application inventory and resource inventory, being able to view everything from that big picture view across all of your different accounts. And for the love of God, stop using IAM users and move over to USSO or like some other identity management solution. There's basically no good reason that I can think of for using IAM users except for IAM access keys and sticking them on-premise VM. Really can't think of one. And monitoring and detection, and those are the really big starting blocks. So I would definitely advise that anybody who's starting out, check out Rami McCarthy's Cloud Security Orienteering blog post. It's fantastic. And Scott Piper's A Security Roadmap. Those are the golden standards that I point everybody to.
Sweet. Also use that. So start with IAM and then use the reference points like the ones done by Scott Piper with Cloud Security Roadmap. What was the other one? Sorry.
And Cloud Security Orienteering. So I believe it's a weird word. I didn't know what it was before, but I think it's the whole idea is when you're getting familiar with, you're just dropped into an, I think it has something to do with cave diving. When you're dropped into an environment and you have no idea what's going on, how do you orient yourself and get familiar with what's happening in those AWS accounts? So,
there you go. We definitely take that from you and put that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, for these are things that you can kind of pursue in parallel, right? Is the identity stuff and like application inventory, starting using infrastructure as code, monitoring and detection.
Secrets manager, you gotta keep like.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. And I think I feel there is definitely a lot that can be done. But after a certain point, it becomes very organization specific as well. To your point, if you're using Lambdas or if you're just a serverless organization, and I mean, IAC is probably, I don't know, that important, I guess, in serverless context, but would you still consider a Lambda world would be IAC driven?
Yeah, I really like the pattern where you separate your infrastructure from your application code. So if you think about it, once I get my infrastructure in place, I'm going to be updating my application code a lot more than the infrastructure code. So being able to update that application code quickly is important, and being able to roll that back is important. And I sometimes don't want to wait until my Terraform pipeline is done running 15 minutes later just to make a little tweak.
Wait, so would you describe your approach to this as more have, I guess, a dedicated Terraform or whichever tool people want to use for IAC, have that as a separate separate CI/CD pipeline, if for lack of a better word, where it just builds the infrastructure and a separate one for the application? Because I mean, and I'm just curious because some people say, oh, the entire application should be on one CI/CD pipeline because technically Terraform should not change anything, but it's still going to go through it. But I'm curious about your thought process there.
Well, that's a pattern that I'm currently really into. I'm not going to go ahead and say everybody needs to do that. So
fair enough.
Yeah, I think everybody who uses the SAM CLI framework from AWS would beg to differ. So I like that one too, but I hate cloud.
Yeah, fair enough. Because I personally find it hard to decide as well. Because sometimes, to your point, you may have one dedicated for an application, and technically things like Terraform or any other IAC languages, they should not really recreate the entire infrastructure unless you change something. It should just go through it and go, well, okay, it's only changing an application. I'm just going to make a change in application. So yeah, I'm definitely curious. If people only who are listening in have a vote on one over the other, definitely feel free to leave that as a comment. Definitely leave a question as well if you have any questions about this. So maybe the next segue could be on this. We spoke about the building blocks of a security program, and clearly, scaling is not about CI/CD pipeline because not everything is covered over there. Mm-hmm. What would you say about scaling security as guardrails in general? I think so. A lot of people may not have the concept of what does scaling security look like, and that's kind of one of the reasons why. Even though we have guardrails, how do you find security scaling in an AWS land? Like, I think guardrails probably is one component. Are there other things as well? You had the example of IAM, don't use IAM users, use a more scalable version of single sign-on. Like when you zoom out a bit and maybe someone like yourself who's trying to implement this, when people ask you what scaling security, what does that really mean for you in an AWS context?
Yeah, well, I mean, we think about scale and how many people are within an organization, right? And I think about scaling security controls is really about how many people do I have in my organization and how quick can I tell them that they're doing something wrong and they need to fix it, right? There's a huge difference between, okay, I have some misconfigured resource where we're not enforcing a hard preventative guardrail yet. How long does it take to tell the developer that? Does it take them, is it before the build if it's preventative, or before it's deployed if it's preventative? If it is it at infrastructure as code, is it if it's preventative, or did they get a Slack notification right after they make a modification in prod, right? So, or is it 24 hours later or months later when somebody sees it manually, or when they run a tool, or when some consultant runs a tool a year later?
Definitely interesting scenarios to food for thought. So how would you say if I ask you about guardrail scaling itself, then it's like, how does one scale guardrails? Because to your point, then if the organizations are described like that, how would you describe scaling security guardrails? Security controls? Or would you say they're the same? Security guardrails?
I just think that having as much automation as you can to whether that's preventative or detective, and having that quick feedback loop to developers is going to make you as successful as possible. Some people solve that through some paid CSPM tool with Slack notifications and prioritizing which ones they alert developers about and which ones they don't. Mm-hmm. Some people solve that through infrastructure as code stuff and a combination of that and monitoring alerting, right? So it depends on the organization.
I'm glad you mentioned the paid CSPM part, because I imagine a lot of people listening to this may go, do I need a paid solution for doing all of this awesome things that Kinnaid have mentioned? Or can I just do this in open source? And you're a huge, kind of like me, you're a huge supporter of open source as well. So I'm curious to hear from you. Do you need open source only?
Yeah, I think a lot of innovation happens in open source first. So, and I think that I don't want to say that everybody should use some paid tool, because I've been the sole person who's responsible for cloud security at an organization before. And man, I'm not going to get approval for all this stuff. Like, I don't have the budget for this, right? So yeah, so if you do have the budget and you're able to shorten the time to get value, and you don't have to get dedicated headcount for certain things, depending on the tool, like, it's useful to maybe consider buying something. But you can get a lot of stuff done with just things that are in open source. So it really depends on where you are. So I did a whole talk on the whole, like, using different open source tools to lock down your AWS program. So it's totally possible. So, but right. I think about it from the point of the whole use open source tools versus buy cloud security tools. And I think especially for smaller teams or just non-Netflix is the world, et cetera, not everybody can afford to have dedicated engineering teams for every little category of cloud security tooling, right?
Fair enough.
And so sometimes that's not even the best solution for the organizations who decide to do that. Some huge organizations, they end up dedicating like 5 really expensive engineers to address an issue that they could have just spent like a lot less money on getting a product, right? So, I mean, they're like anything, there are trade-offs.
Very well-balanced answer, Kinnaid, just saying. To your point then, from a team perspective then, as you were referring, like, some people may not even have the option. It might just be one person looking after the entire cloud security of, like, I don't know, hundreds of like AWS accounts. What are some of the team skills that you think these JS people should have from a cloud security perspective? And maybe not just cloud security, but someone who probably has to be, to what you said, one person has heard this interview and I, oh, great. And I have to implement a security program in AWS on my hundreds of AWS accounts. I'm only little old me. How would you say, I guess we've already spoken about how they would approach it, but what kind of skill set would they require to do something like this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to have the curiosity to like go tinker with things and like a willingness to learn, and having a background with some coding experience definitely helps. But I mean, I started out in the cloud security space with, I started writing Python, I think it was 2 years ago, right? So yeah, so just having a willingness to learn and a sense of practicality and the ability to like prioritize things and not shame developers. Those are like the most important personal qualities. But skill set wise, being able to think about things from a risk prioritized perspective and understanding the cloud provider itself. I think that certifications aren't everything, but it's a good sign and a good intro to things to in the AWS space to get that associate certification, get that security certification, as long as you're actually doing those things and not just trying to pass the test. The labs are where it's at.
You're saying I won't get a job if I just do certifications?
I'm actually terrible at certifications. And I guess I can say this now because I'm considered an AWS security expert, but I failed the AWS associate certification the first 2 times. So.
All right. I failed the professional one the first time I wrote it. So you and I are not that different, man. I think you may know, it's funny. I don't know if that's the right exam to judge the kind of skill set people have. Maybe.
Yeah. But it's about the on-the-job experience. And are you actually, like, if you actually go and build something using some of those services, then you're going to learn a whole lot more than just studying the slides or following one lab, right? So
yeah, I know we joke about this, but it's also the thing where you can look at projects around your existing organization as well, which could be in cloud. There's so many other ways to get the experience.
Yeah.
And they I don't think you'll pass the AWS XE special. without really learning. I agree. I think that so Zena's on the money there. We would not pass the AWS exam just because we are learning and we're like, oh, we can go back to the office and implement all of this. Yeah, but I don't know if I'll derail the whole, what do you call it, the AWS certification exam just by calling out the fact that it's very AWS centric. Like you almost have to kind of, and I'm sure other people who listen to this would agree that it's more like when you're giving an exam as well, oh, was this service released? Because I would have answered this question in a way that, I don't know, something that was released yesterday, but the exam hasn't updated for 6 months or 1 year or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're asking about a service which doesn't even exist anymore or it's not even used properly. So
yeah,
I'm sure that people have instances like that as well.
Well, they're also created by AWS. I feel like sometimes they're a bit of an advertisement for some of the different services that they have. And they're not going to go in and say, this is the riskiest thing with AWS cloud, or this is really bad and you need to stay away from this. You really need to not do this thing. They're not going to take that tone or really show you the really bad things and that can happen. So if you want a good kick out of like what the bad things that can happen in AWS, I'd definitely say check out Nick for Hacking the Cloud. Yeah, it's a really good like cloud like cheat sheet for different commands and different things that you can do when you're trying to like escalate privileges or really do anything when you like establish a foothold in the cloud environment. So
yeah,
a lot of fun.
Yeah, perfect. I want a question from Ben as well. In your experience, is there a certain lifecycle or timeline that works well for implementing a security guardrail and transitioning it from a detective to a preventative control? Great question, Ben.
Yeah. So, I mean, the timeline kind of depends on how many bugs you're dealing with. So you want to get to a point where you're buying down some of the bugs. You have some ways of making sure that they're not going to inflate. So you have some Terraform, I keep using the defensive Terraform modules example. But, and then at a certain point, you grant exceptions for all the people who are really lagging behind. So you can put things into enforcement mode. So in my experience, that's been most effective. And then you buy those remaining ones down. So it's a journey. I really want to stay from giving an arbitrary deadline. I don't want your boss to get mad at you if a little bit longer, because if you have some teams that are straggling behind.
Yeah, fair enough. And that's a great question from Ben as well, because I think it's worthwhile calling out that just because something starts off as a detective control, it should always remain a detective control. It should slowly transition onto, like, it should become a practice rather than, I'm preventing Ashish from opening up their S3 bucket to the internet. At some point, you kind of have a transition. So it kind of becomes like a norm in the organization instead of just waiting, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet. Actually, I've got a comment here from Vinit as well. When renew certs, they make you go and check new certs. Oh, right. Okay, there you go. They make you go check. But I wasn't aware of it. Thanks for that, Vinit. Cool. All right. We are towards the tail end. I just got one more question. What's your recommendation for, like, I think we're going into a space where we spoke about how to scale, what security guardrails are. How does one even learn about this stuff? Like, I think, what was your approach to learning about scaling security guardrails that maybe you can share with other people who are thinking about going this? I'm assuming you would not say AWS documentation.
Yeah, or AWS control tower. That would not be my recommendation. I learned that.
I've never heard anyone just say, oh yeah, you can learn scaling security from AWS documentation. Definitely not. So what's your approach?
My approach was I got on that cloud security forum Slack and I was just talking with other people about what we found to be effective or different cool controls that you could put in place. That's where I got into SCPs and good, like getting down to least privilege IAM policies, et cetera. So, I mean, one of the cool things about cloud security is that we're still very early and we get to help define what security in the cloud means, right? And so, I think I've got into cloud security like 6 years ago, right? And so there was none of that stuff, right? And even a few years ago, there were a lot less like standards or like awareness about some of these different things. So, I mean, I think the thing that's helped me the most is just being involved in the community.
Yeah, good point. And I think to what you said as well, I don't know if how many people realize we're still scratching the surface of cloud security. Like you and I have been in this for over 5 years, 6 years, but it still feels like, sometimes you still say the same things that you were saying like 6 years ago, but sometimes like, oh, that's new. Like, I kind of had that moment, but I don't know if you had those moments as well.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the next stage of cloud security tooling really across, and I think this goes beyond just cloud security or like CSPM kind of tools, is tools that understand prioritization. I know a lot of security vendors like to show, like, hey, we found all these crazy critical findings. At a certain point, if you're just showing a ton of critical findings that have no context, people are just going to write you off. Yeah. And so helping security engineers prioritize, and I think applying graph theory in some kind of way, is that's where the next generation of security tools in general, like not even just cloud, I think that's where they're going to be.
Wait, hey, don't drop the word observability in there now. Suddenly it's like, that's also
observability. Man, observability is just like some, it's having like a tracing IDs and just putting them everywhere in your structured logging and then throwing them.
Although I joke about it, but that's much more harder than what you would think it's to implement.
Yeah.
Because like, have you tried doing it?
Yeah. It's a pain. Total pain.
Oh my God. Like, I think it's the metrics that I'm like, what am I really using as my telemetry? And I'm like,
I know.
I don't know if it's actually, maybe that's a great last question then. Do you think the observability platform, at least in the little experience you may have had, and I'm just, this is my curious personal question, where observability is at that stage where it can be started, we can start using them for, say, cloud security?
Yeah, because I recently ventured into trying to figure out some auto diagramming tools, and they're for serverless. Okay, I don't want to be too extreme here, but a lot of them are really terrible. And so I'm only able to really get a good service map going. Like, it's some of those tools are better with, like, if I have EC2 instances sitting in a subnet. But honestly, after spending so much time building those kind of infrastructures, I want to not have to handle servers and infrastructure as much as possible. And so the only way to get like a really good service map going is with those observability tools. I feel like, and if you have Lambdas talking to all these different services in AWS, you're not always going to see that they're actually doing that unless you're tracing it. So I think those kind of tools can add more context into what is actually happening in your account, and then the different points at which, like the different attack vectors that could be present.
Sweet. And I've got a good comment from Zenith as well. That's good to hear, Ashish. I was in cloud security around 10 months and sometimes going crazy why I don't know so much. The more you learn, the more nothing. Yeah, that's exactly right. I don't know, do you have any thoughts on what's your experience in cloud been so far, Kinnaird?
Just with all these new services coming out and
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. It's difficult for everybody to keep up. So, I mean, I think when I first wrote like Policy Center, I think there were 150 different services, and what are we at, like 250 or something like that?
Yeah, it's insane.
Wouldn't be surprised
if it's
even more.
Reinvent is coming down the route as well. So there's another 50, 60 coming up.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. But the cool thing is with that, there's a lot of opportunities for cool security research into some of these different services. And I know there are standards for any interested security researchers out there. I know that we have existing lists of privilege escalation and different security ways of escalating privilege, different risky permissions, et cetera, for mischief in cloud. But there are a lot more out there that hasn't been covered. And there's some cool research coming out later this year from some folks. And if you're interested, there's still a lot of opportunities, a good way to make your mark and help define what cloud security really means.
Actually, it's a good point, because even cloud security research too, it's definitely been one of those services you almost hear that and go, do we still have to go down the path next? But it's absolutely required on the money. And as I say that, I got distracted again. But so Zenith would like to know more about the auto drawing tool. What was your conclusion after finding all the auto drawing?
Oh, yeah. The import your infrastructure kind of tools that are like not the, I don't want to get into some of the observability tooling that I like, because I don't want to seem like I have any affiliation with some of them, but, and I also don't want to dunk on some of these auto drawing tools, but I will say that Lucidchart, their pricing has gotten to be way too expensive. So I'm not paying hundreds of dollars a month for that as an individual.
Because there's a free one called draw.io. I think I kind of commented on your thing. There was like a 3D diagram one as well, which is, I think they're free. Like, so there's plenty.
Here,
But I think to Zena's point, for maybe don't recommend a person, but what was the conclusion of how you should approach auto drawing, I guess?
That,
which is there another way of, apart from us importing my entire CloudFormation template or my entire infrastructure, hooking up AWS accounts? Is there any other way of outside of that?
I mean, I will say that there are a lot of opportunities for tools in that space. So I would love to. I mean, because the thing is, I'll go and I'll create a diagram of my AWS infrastructure. And I hope that anybody reading that a few months or years into the future realizes that it is an artifact from that point in time, because it grows and it changes, right? And so
yeah,
I hope more and more auto diagramming tools come out that can, that aren't terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point, it's where, to what you said, you may have deployed a version maybe using CloudFormation template, and AWS has that drift detection or whatever that they have as a service, so you can see the drift. But not everyone's using CloudFormation template. Yeah. Some people may just go, I'm just going to use Terraform and build using that. I don't have to use anything else. So
yeah.
Did you want to add anything to that?
I just think about infrastructure as code that, like on the serverless side, we have there's still a long way to go. And that, I think the serverless framework folks are really onto something, but I don't think that as an industry we're there yet with infrastructure as code. So think about this, right? So AWS Lambdas have a cool feature where you're able to do blue-green deployments by pointing between different Lambda versions and rolling it back, right?
Yeah.
I know the service framework has a plugin for that, but I mean, it's a community-given plugin, and I don't see other infrastructure as code tools using something like that. And man, like Kubernetes folks get automated rollbacks. Why can't we have that? Why can't we have preferably open source framework that will allow us to take advantage of that kind of thing outside of one vendor tool? So, and something that everybody uses. So, I mean, I think there's a big opportunity there for somebody to go build a framework.
So you can do auto
take
rollback.
That free idea.
Well, yeah. Well, there's a startup idea right there for anyone who's basically sitting auto rollback as well. So wait, so if we're saying someone should make a tool, Zenas, we could inspire you as well, hopefully. That's a great question to inspire all of this. You could totally do a startup. What was it again? Auto rollback.
I'm going to go use some buzzwordy phrase right here, but some Kubernetes for serverless thing. That would be really nice. Yeah. Being able to get
Kubernetes
those automated
for serverless. Fair enough. Thanks for that. But hopefully you find a tool which is helpful. Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't have a recommendation at this point in time. We've got a comment from Jyoti as well. A few services are interrelated, but with slight functionality update. It's cool, but tricky intellection based on requirements. I think they're referring to the services that are being and how you would apply security to it, I think. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Joe. Terraform has graph features too, but not that good. Have you used the graph features in Terraform?
I've generated the diagram before, and even if you just have a few resources, it's way too detailed for... I think it's more related to like the internals of Terraform and what they use rather than anything that would be useful for viewing the actual architecture.
Sweet. Cool. Yeah. All right. I don't know if you've had a very different experience, but thank you for sharing that as well. And it sounds like it's great. It's a great podcast episode or live stream. And you, towards the end, you kind of come up with a startup. So thanks to Zenith, Vineet, and Jyoti and Ben for the great question and helping us brew a startup idea over here before you even finish this. That was pretty much what I had for the show, man. Where can people find you to connect with you and probably talk more about scaling AWS Guardrails and all the other projects that you're working on?
Yeah. I mean, best place to contact me is probably on Twitter or in the Cloud Security Slack. Those are the best. I don't really check LinkedIn.
Yeah. Also, fair enough. I don't know how, well, unfortunately, I do quite a bit of LinkedIn. So there you go.
Twitter.
He has so many hidden talents. I think it's worthwhile highlighting. Zenith used to be a lawyer as well before she moved into cloud security. It's amazing the kind of world we have where so many different talents kind of come in from different fields after doing for so many years. I definitely love hearing about people who are from a very different background and come into technology and go into cybersecurity. So thanks for sharing that, man.
Yeah, for sure, man. We all have awesome little things about us. So,
100%. I think we definitely have a lot of people. So people can find you on Twitter, and for everyone else, thank you everyone for tuning in. Definitely check out the entire episode on YouTube, but leave a comment if you have any questions for either me or Kinnaird, and we'll be happy to answer them later on as well. Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah.
And
thanks
we'll
for having
see
me.
You. I'll see you next week, but maybe hopefully we can have Kinnaird again.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Cloud Security Podcast. If you found some new information from that episode, we would appreciate if you share it with others. Share it with us as well if you have any good feedback or good learnings from the episode. We are on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you don't find us there, you can always go on our website, www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv, to listen to the latest episode. We appreciate your support in helping us grow. It helps us bring more guests. It helps us support the channel. So really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time, and talk to you on the next episode.